Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento Fine Foods at cento.com, that's C-E-N-T-O.com, and King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Second edition here of Food Talk, Mike Colomeco's Food Talk here on Heritage Radio Network, broadcast live today from bucolic, sunny Bushwick, Brooklyn. The L train. Every time I get on the L train, I'm the only guy that doesn't have any tattoos. Once we cross the river, I think I am. It might be a mark of distinction here at some point. But anyway, the show's Food Talk. I'm your host, Mike Colomeco. Give you a little idea here. I'm going to do a little show intro rundown for about 10, 15 minutes, talk about some topics that are sort of germane to the day, to the season, to the world of food. And that's going to lead us into an interview that I have with a great writer, a guy who I really admire, Michael Ruhlman, R-U-H-L-M-A-N. You probably know his other books, pretty much every book that Thomas Keller's written that has to do with the French Laundry or Bouchon has been co-authored with Michael, as well as a bunch of other works that he's done. Back in the day when I was doing normal broadcast radio for 6 years, I had the sort of privilege opportunity to have that platform at WOR over in downtown Manhattan. We had a weekday show for 2.5 years and then a weekend show for 6. So I got tons of cookbooks that got sent my way. Cookbooks are just such a popular subject these days. There's thousands of new titles that come out every year, and they would land on my porch at my house in Cape May, where I do most of my reading on weekends, and I was just astonished. I mean, to this day, how bad most cookbooks are. They're just terrible. I mean, I guess there's an appetite out there. Publishers keep cranking them out. Amazon and bricks and mortar stores keep selling them, and I guess people keep buying them, but I'm just astounded at how lousy most of them are. As a chef who's spent an entire career, lifetime, really, in the kitchen, you can just sort of flip through the pages of most of these books and say, this isn't going to work. That's not going to look like the picture. No way. Not going to happen. So I would bring it to the Strand and just, you know, donate thousands of pounds of cookbooks a year that would end up back on resale at 12th and Broadway. Let somebody pick them up there. But there are exceptional books, and I try and get those authors on from time to time. And Michael really writes some good stuff. He actually became interested in food, attended and graduated from the Culinary Institute, which is my alma mater way back in the day. I graduated in January of 82. Yeah, wow, long time ago. But Michael, so you know, went to cooking school, really sort of wrapped his head around cooking, and then proceeded to write some really, really good books. He has a wonderful book that we're not going to talk with him today about, but it's great, and I would recommend it to anybody that's out there, that if you're listening to this and you're into food, you're probably cooking a lot, right? Well, he has a cookbook called Ratio, R-A-T-I-O, just like it sounds, that's wonderful, and he got the sort of nexus for that cookbook from an instructor that he and I both had together at the CIA, a guy named Uwe Hess. German expat who brought his fine mind and skills to the Culinary Institute. He was one of my favorite instructors up there. We became friends. I was a guest at Uwe's house a couple times off campus to have dinner with his wife and kids. And Ratio is really simple, because what Mike does in that book is sort of break down the relationship between liquids, fats, and starches in recipes, so that one understands after a while that it is all about ratio. There's this great commonality to a lot of recipes, and once you sort of understand how it works, you can cook in a much more relaxed mode. The book, however, we're going to talk about today is his latest book, which is why we brought him on the show. It's a book that when I first saw it, when I first unwrapped it, these, you know, books come and they come wrapped on my porch, and I rip open the box and I'm like, what is in this thing? And the title is Schmaltz, and I'm like, you're kidding me. And on it, I think there's a spoon. I don't have the book in front of me, but I think there's a picture of a spoon with schmaltz on it. For those of you that don't know what schmaltz is, I won't tell you. We're going to find out, but let's just say it has a lot to do with old-school cooking, Eastern European, Central European cooking, and fat. And it's funny, because As a chef and a guy who sort of just lives in the world of food, I've got a PBS show that I've had for 12 years. We're shooting our 13th season now. If you're listening to this locally, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, we're on every week, Sunday afternoons at 3:30 on Channel 13, broadcast here in New York City as well as New Jersey Public Television. Next year we'll be on in Create, which is a digital space that PBS started a couple of years ago that's coast to coast. So I'm looking forward to having the 13th season roll out nationally. And while I don't cook anymore professionally in restaurants, I'm in restaurants all the time, interviewing chefs, filming with chefs, telling their stories. That's what the show's about, sort of backstage passes to the world of the industry. We're really phobic about fat in this country, just like a boogeyman every couple of years, right? Salt seems to be in everybody's target these days as one of those ingredients that we should avoid. And it just rubs me the wrong way, because the fact of the matter is your body needs salt and your body needs fat, and it always has. The trouble with most Americans' diet and the problem with Americans being overweight these days and a lot of the health issues that relate to that, like type 2 diabetes, is the fact that we just eat way too much sugar and way too much processed foods, and there's way too much fat and salt in all that stuff. So if you're shopping those middle aisles of the supermarket buying pre-made meal solutions and canned foods, they're just laden with tons of sodium and tons of fat, and it's, you know, food's just cheap in America. We eat too many calories. It's just easy for us. I always say it's, if you look back historically, the picture of poverty, historically, up until this past generation, the portrait of poverty would be a very gaunt mom and dad with their cheekbones exposed and, you know, just bony with a couple of really skinny kids in raggedy clothes. That's what poor used to look like, and still does for most of the rest of the world. But it's funny, in America now, in a lot of neighborhoods that are really sort of underprivileged and where there's not a lot of supermarkets and options, the picture of poverty today is people that are heavy. Americans just eat too many calories. So Michael and I will wax poetically about the benefits of fat, all the good things you can do with it. And the truth is, I walk that walk. I'm a while back, when I hit 40 to 50 in that decade, like a lot of guys, like a lot of people, my metabolism slowed down. I was a chef. I started doing radio. I was going out to dinner every night. And little by little, I gained 5-6 pounds a year, which doesn't sound like much until you get to the 10th year of that equation and you're 60 pounds over where you always were. So as a guy that ran 5 New York marathons, used to box competitively for the New York Athletic Club, was a paid sparring partner at Gleason's, I have 2 black belts, I was always ripped and in great shape. And then I woke up one day at 50 and just, who is that guy in the mirror? And, you know, it was gross. I mean, you know, being heavy isn't fun. It's not good for you. It's hard to lose that weight. It's hard to work out when you hit a certain point. So I just decided diets don't work. I knew that. I've been in this industry my whole life. If you ever watch people that go on, quote, diets, they may or may not lose weight within the confines of the diet. And when they get off of it, almost invariably, they're back to the same weight within 6 months. So I just said, you know, it's calories in, calories out. Really simple equation. I know how much I work out, but it doesn't burn as many calories as nearly as most people think. So let's just cut it back, 2,200 calories a day. Realize that calories includes Negronis, calories include wine. About a third of our calories sneak in via the beverage side of the equation. And that's what I did. I just cut back on what I ate. I cut back on portion sizes, and I started to eat tons more fruit and vegetables. And that gave me the sense, not the illusion, but the real sense that I was full after a meal. So the protein shrank. The size of the vegetable portions would often double or triple. I tried to eat a lot more whole grains when I could. And yeah, it wasn't easy. The first month, you know, I was a little bit hungry a lot. I was drinking a lot of water. Took me a bit to get my brain used to the idea and my stomach that what a meal was going to look like was going to be about half of what it used to be. But after a month, it was really, really easy. And over the course of the next year, bingo, 60 pounds gone. That was a long time ago. Have not put a pound of it back on since. I eat everything I want. Still drink Negronis before dinner, still have wine with dinner, but it's really about managing calories in, calories out sort of stuff. So, and I did not cut back on that. Still cook with olive oil, still buy really good butter at I love the butter I can get at Ann Saxelby's little cheese kiosk down there in the Essex Market. I've been spoiled, so that's the butter that I bring home and stash, and that's what I eat with. That's what I cook with. It's great. Love olive oil again, and I'm trying to make schmaltz. Ever since I read this book and had this conversation with Michael, I've got a little. I live in Co-op Village on the Lower East Side there on Grand Street, all the way down by the Williamsburg Bridge. Great neighborhood, just tucked in there between Chinatown and the south side of Delancey and the Lower East Side to my north and Little Italy directly to my west. It's a great little neighborhood. And downstairs in my building, there's a kosher butcher who sells all sorts of stuff, including lots and lots of chicken, and he doesn't have schmaltz, and I can't find chicken fat. So I've got to find make a deal. Last couple times I've been in, he hasn't been in. So you got to talk to the boss, they tell me. So I got to wait for the boss one of these days and say, hey, can you do me a favor? You know, like the next time you're cutting up birds to sell in parts, can you just save me the fat and the skin, and I will buy it from you? You name the price so I can go home and make schmaltz. Because people have been using fat for years. I just told you, last week I was here, I just got back from a trip to Poland, a country I'd never been to. I was in Poland for almost 2 weeks, the middle of September. And I kept seeing commonly used there in that sort of Slavic, Germanic cuisine was pork fat that they use as just a spread. It's a condiment. They render pork fat down. Sometimes it'll have little pieces of crispy meat in it. Sometimes it'll be just completely clean. And they use it to saute. They use it in baking. They use it for all sorts of stuff. And it just makes sense because if you go back in time, I mean, fat in and of itself is an expensive thing. It's a luxury. And today we go to the supermarkets and we can buy these half-gallon quarts of cooking oil. But for a lot of the world, cooking oil is a real luxury. In fact, you know, one of the things that ignited the Arab Spring was the cost of cooking oil way back when, however many, 3-4 years ago, in Egypt. It's just oil's expensive stuff. So when you slaughter an animal and you have all that natural fat, you render it and you do something with it. Every culture does the same thing. It's worth its weight in gold in kitchens. So again, and the salt thing, don't even get me started with that. Again, if you cook, I cook at home for myself, and I know exactly how much salt I eat every day because it's coming out of my hands. I cook, I know I get a little container of kosher salt, I keep some sea salt on my table, and I can almost count the amount of little sprinkles that are between my thumb and my index finger that I put on food. And it's just not much, you know, it isn't much. So if you're eating processed foods, it's full of salt. If you're cooking for yourself at home, which really, I'm sure if you're listening to this program and to any and all of Heritage Radio Network's great programming, that you're a cook and you're interested in food, just don't eat processed food. Cook at home, season your food with salt, and I am sure you'll fall within the daily guidelines and parameters. Again, you're listening to Food Talk, new program here on Heritage. I'm happy to be here with the Heritage Radio Network team. You can find us at heritageradionetwork.org. And there's a phone number. We don't encourage a lot of live calling because it's really not that kind of show. But if you have a pen and pencil and you have a question at some point, you can email us at heritageradionetwork.org while we're live, or you could call us old school. The phone number is 718-497-2128. Again, the in-studio number. Hopefully somebody answers it. If you should want to call, you can email or call. But the phone number again is 718-497-2128. The show is Food Talk. It's great to be back. Lots to talk about. I have to say, there was one restaurant I want to talk longer about it because I'm writing a piece for Guitar Aficionado magazine. I know it's weird. It's a guitar magazine, but I write about food for them. Great magazine, by the way, if you're into guitars. It's sort of like the guitar porn magazine with all these great collections and fancy musicians and their gear. But they have a column that I write that's about food. 6 times a year the magazine comes out. And I'm writing a piece just about Dunnett on a restaurant that I visited in Warsaw that everybody told me, oh, this place is great. You're going to love it. Great restaurant. But so much of that is hype. I'm just so used to PR people pitching me the next great chef story that doesn't pan out on the plate. Often in my experience, I'm picky and I'll be my own judge. But I'd heard about this guy. Wojciech Amaro is his name. The name of the restaurant's Amaro. It's a beautiful little restaurant right in the middle of a park in Warsaw. And I went in and the chef was a couple of minutes late and sort of we talked for a while and got along well with a little interview that we did upstairs. And then we put on whites and went downstairs and I spent the day in the kitchen with him. And I was blown away. If you're anywhere near Warsaw, if you're traveling in Eastern Europe and you're going to be near Poland or in Germany and you're really into food, it's the first restaurant in the history of Polish cuisine to get a Michelin star within 2 years of opening. He got got a Michelin star, which is a great honor for any chef in Europe. I'm not such a big fan of Michelin in America, but we'll leave that whole discussion of criticism, food criticism, and food writing in this country for another show. But in Europe, it's kind of the gold standard. I think European chefs dream of getting a Michelin star, maybe two in their wildest dreams, three. He got one 2 years out of the gate, which is pretty astonishing. And I'll tell you something. I've eaten in most three-star restaurants in Europe, a ton of twos and a boatload of ones. And this guy is on his way to a second star, I'm sure. He's just a fanatic about ingredients. All the ingredients he uses, he sources from Poland. He keeps a list 52 weeks out of the year on ingredient availability. And he's got this huge list on his computer. And according to him, week 37 and 38, which falls the second and third week or third and fourth week of September, he's got over 500 ingredients available. End of summer stuff, beginning of fall stuff. And that's what he uses. And then he'll pick things in season and pickle them or preserve them so that he can use them out of season, but they're still local. But an amazing menu comprised of all sorts of stuff from all over Poland. And I was just blown away because he wasn't entirely one of these technique guys, although he did work with Ferrand and he did work with Rene at Noma. He's not one of these guys who does a ton of manipulation, so you're not seeing a lot of starches and alkaloids. And he really doesn't even use sous vide a whole lot, just kind of makes, gets great ingredients, forages with his crew on his day off. Believe it or not, I think a quarter to a third of Poland's landmass is national parks, and many of them are protected national parks. So they go in those parks and forage for stuff, and they've got bison grass and local geese and local boar and deer and berries from fir trees. I mean, incredible selection of mushrooms. It was just such an amazing kitchen. My only regret is I didn't get to eat there, but I was there for lunch and he fed me a ton of food while I was sitting next to him. So, but didn't get to do the sit-down thing, but next time I'm in Poland, I will. So if you're ever around again, the restaurant's name is Amaro. It's in Warsaw, Atelier Amaro, to be actually completely correct in the title. Atelier Amaro, A-M-A-R-O is the chef's name. Great, great restaurant in Warsaw. You know what? Let's cut. I did this great interview with Michael Ruhlman. It is a taped interview. Mike goes back and forth between his residences in Ohio and in Greenwich Village now, the West Village. So I got him when he was in town. The title of the book is Schmaltz, and I'll let the whole the tape that we have, the interview that we have, it'll be complete. You'll have the intro. You'll get the story. So I'm not going to give it away. Stay tuned. That's what's coming up next here on Heritage Radio Network.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
You're listening to Easy Riding Child by Brothers NYC on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey folks, welcome back. The show is Food Talk with Mike Colomeco. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find us on the web. You can find us at iTunes, Stitcher. Again, that's HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Mike Colomeco. My guest is Michael Ruhlman. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You know, I have you on the radio before in one of my past lives for one of you. I think it was Ratio, because we both went to the CIA. And Uwe Hessner actually became like one of my sort of mentors up there. I was actually he invited me to his house for lunch at one point, and
he
was such a great guy. And the fact that that idea for the book came from him just blew me away.
Yeah, it was. But the thing is, he planted that idea in my head
right
10 years earlier before I finally said, "This idea is so fabulous, I can't stop thinking, and I got to write about a book about it." So
yeah,
that's why
and
I wrote Ratio.
It is, for if you haven't read the book, it's a great book for among many many reasons. One of my favorite ones is it really does something I'm always trying to do, which is it demystifies cooking. I think people are so locked into recipes and measuring and that whole, and it's not like that. That's not how our grandmothers cook. That's not how really chefs work most of the time. Just some of your other books are the Salumi, The Craft of Italian Dry Curing, a couple of books with Thomas Keller, Bouchon, and that amazing
all
French Laundry cookbook, all the books, The Reach of a Professional Chef, The Soul of a Chef, and we have you here today, The Book of Schmaltz. So I guess we'll just start at the beginning. Who is Lois?
Lois Baron is my wonderful neighbor, and I've always loved fat, and I've loved it especially because America was so afraid of it. And you as a chef know that fat is wonderful. Fat is a great, we need fat. We need fat to digest essential nutrients. We need fat for flavor. We need fat to cook with. And here was America fearful of it. So I wrote a book called Charcuterie. A new edition has just come out as well of that, which is mainly about animal fat and salt. Two of America's big bugaboos. And it did amazingly well. And so I kept exploring fat, and there was this one fat, schmaltz, that I knew about, rendered chicken fat, and I thought, God, I got to explore this sometime. And it was in the back of my mind for a couple of years, and then I was at a neighborhood party, and Lois Barron was there, and she said, "Oh, the high holy days are upon us. I got to go home and make schmaltz." And I thought, here's my opportunity. That was the siren call for me to go learn schmaltz from someone who knew it, who learned it from her grandmother,
right.
and who learned it from the Ashkenazi Jews from where it came.
And this isn't, I mean, you're a goyim, so this wasn't part of your background. You didn't grow up working in the delis. You weren't celebrating the holidays.
I'm a goy. Goyim is plural.
We're goyim. You're a goy.
Yes.
That's right. Okay. I stand corrected. Thank you. I just got back from a trip. First time I was ever in Poland. We were filming in Poland for 10, 12 days. And one of the things I kept seeing in all the kitchens was rendered pork fat with little bits of meat in it. And the exact same idea that you're butchering this animal, so you're going to use its blood for blood sausage, all the organs for something, from the casings to the stomach lining, to the head, the nose, everything gets used.
Everything.
And then you have all of this fat. Why not? So typically in Polish cuisine, they rendered it down and it would go into dishes. It's what they sauteed pierogies in. It became kind of the basis for the, quote, sauce for pierogies half the time we had them. How does one make schmaltz at home?
One makes schmaltz at home either by saving the fat that you can pull off a chicken if you're going to roast a chicken and trim off any excess skin, or you can buy chicken thighs and pull the skin off them. So you get a collection, like a couple cups of fat and skin, and chop it all up, put it in a pan with a little water, and cook it down. That water will cook off, start the rendering process, then all the fat will render out, and you'll be left with the protein of the skin, which are the cracklings, which is the hard, delicious, tasty stuff, chicken cracklings. You add some onion for flavor. Lois taught me this was that it wasn't schmaltz unless you put some onion in there. And the onion really does add a sweetness and depth of flavor. And you strain it all out, and what you're left with is this clear, golden fat and a strainer full of deep brown, delicious chicken cracklings with onion, and it's so delicious. And the fat is like nothing else. That's what I love about schmaltz, is you have to make it yourself. You can't really go out and buy it. It's kind of volatile, so even delis that sell it, it's not quite the same as when you make it at home. Like mayonnaise. Mayonnaise is great at the store, but when you make it at home, it's a completely different product. So schmaltz is only something you can truly make at home, I believe. And then it gives a flavor that is unlike anything else. It's the flavor of roasted plus chicken plus onion. So browning chicken and onion, it combines those flavors. And anything cooked in it, like potatoes cooked in it, take on this depth that you don't get. You just don't get from bland olive oil.
Right, and it's, well, don't say that about olive oil. It'd be nice about olive oil. But the other oils.
No, I meant vegetable oil. I love olive oil.
No, it's true. Most of us, I mean, I guess the reference point for a lot of cooks is, if you're kind of a serious cook, you render bacon fat and you save the bacon fat, because why throw that away when you're going to make something the next day that's
so good?
It's going to need an oil, and you already have that smokiness, the porkiness, the seasoning in it. I have one question for you, because I've never made schmaltz. So I'm going to add the water in the beginning because it just kind of makes life easier rather than rendering it dry. It's going to bring it up to a boiling point. Then that water is going to cook out. It's going to evaporate.
Exactly.
And as the fat starts to render, where's my heat on this? Medium low, just slow and low, or when do you turn it down?
I boil it till the water's gone and you can tell that the fat is...
You hear it.
You hear it crackling, because as soon as there's so little water, it will start crackling. The water will start crackling in the fat that's now there. So now you've got some fat rendered gently by the gentle temperature of the boiling water, relatively gentle, 212 degrees.
Yep.
And then you turn it to low and let it cook down. And hopefully you're not in a hurry and you can just let it cook naturally. But you can do medium low if you want to speed things up. You're going to need to stir it. It'll want to stick to the pan. You don't want it to burn. And then about just when the skin is turning brown, but not crisp, you add the onion. And then you let that onion brown, and when the skin is crisp, but the oil is still golden, you don't want to roast the oil too much, give it that roasted flavor, then it's done. And then you strain it, and you have two beautiful creations.
Yeah, and the Grivenesses, is just, I mean, a little fleur de sel, a little salt on those, and good luck putting that down. They'll probably disappear in the next hour. How do you hold schmaltz once you've made it?
Great question. Lois is right. She has found, and I agree with her, that it's pretty volatile, so it'll keep for a week in the fridge, but then it starts losing its specialness. So if you're not going to use it for a week, put it in the freezer. It freezes well for half a year. So if the kipper's over and you've still got schmaltz left, you can put it in for Passover, when you start doing your Passover dishes.
You've got a bunch of recipes in here that are great. So we find out who Lois is, and then we find out about schmaltz. And I'm going to stop you just for a minute. We're going to go backwards to something you began with. And I've been doing radio for a long time, had a lot of guests on, from David Kessler, who was the head of the FDA. And we talked about this dilemma of Americans being overweight and the various causes of it. And to your point, you talk about it in the book, and I've said it a million times, but I want it in your voice. This misnomer about fat versus processed foods. Talk a little bit about that, because I do the two things you mentioned, and I rail about this too, is people are fat phobic like crazy and salt phobic like crazy, which is
It's wrong.
Both of them are completely wrong on their heads. Talk about that a little bit, because I want it from your voice.
It drives me absolutely crazy. I see these stories on the news about how bad fat is. ABC News, salt, the killer, salt. It's just not true. Fat doesn't make us fat. Eating too much makes us fat. Eating crappy food makes us fat. Eating tons of fat on pizza is going to eventually make you fat if you eat enough of it. But fat isn't what makes us fat. It's the amount of calories we eat that makes us fat. So we need to revise how we think about food. And if we eat natural food, food that we cook ourselves, I think that's the biggest problem, is we stop cooking for ourselves. When we cook our own food, our bodies regulate what we need. You know the days that you come home and you say, God, you know, I just really want a great salad. That's because your body is telling you that. Or other days you say, oh, I would love a steak tonight. I feel really like, because your body is telling you it wants that protein and it wants that fat. So if you cook your own foods and listen to what your body says, and don't eat to stuff yourself, eat till you're not hungry anymore. And don't eat when you're not hungry. So this country has just gone crazy about food, and they've gone crazy. They've become obsessed about it because it's making us sick, and it is. But it's not the fat that's making us sick. It's the processed food that's making us sick.
Yeah, you mentioned Lois is, we're not going to mention her age, but she's over 70, and she seems doing fine. Her kids are great. Her daughter's a bicyclist.
Oh, that's another thing.
Her son's great. I mean, and then when I thought back of my grandparents, who were Italian immigrants, who ate everything. I mean, they ate all sorts of organ meat and heavy, you know, all the stuff that is kind of taboo, lived well into their 80s. And I think of all these generations of people that have done this same thing, maybe the advice that you and I would both agree on is shop the perimeter of the supermarket, cook for yourself, and don't eat processed foods. That's where the salt comes from. That's where the garbage comes from.
Yep, absolutely.
I was finally relieved to see Michael Pollan, who's written some wonderful, wonderful cautionary tales and books about food. I remember having on the radio saying, do you cook? I mean, at some point, you're right. You're kind of giving us everything but... The key that you just said is to take control of it. Cook.
Right.
Cook at home.
Well, he's the guy who first identified this idea, and he did it. He was talking to a nutritionist about it. It was in his New York Times cover story, magazine cover story. No one's cooking anymore.
Oh, I remember this one. That ironically, 35 years ago, when Julia Childs was on TV, people were cooking 30-some minutes a day at home. Now it's less. Now we watch TV, adore
exactly.
Chefs, have this whole going about
it. Exactly. So he was addressing this conundrum here, and he was talking to a nutritionist about, you know, how we're eating today and what it means to not cook and why we're getting obese. And the nutritionist, you can almost hear him on the page getting angry, saying, here's a diet. You know, you want to know a good diet? I'll tell you a good diet. Cook your own food. And it's true. And Michael Pollan pretty much turned that into a book.
Yeah, it's the latest. Speaking of books, we're talking to Michael Ruhlman. He's the author of, the author of many great books. The latest one's The Book of Schmaltz. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Mike Colomeco. The show's Food Talk. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or again, just at our website, HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're going to take a quick break and be back with more.
I'm
Hey folks, Mike Colomaco here. When I'm at home and I want to make a great tomato sauce, well, it starts with shopping, and I always go for Cento brand San Marzano tomatoes. It comes from a region just outside of Naples in the foothills of Mount Vesuvius, where there's this amazing volcanic soil, a super clean high water table that the Greeks were raving about eons ago. It's a special place with a special microclimate, and it's really a unique tomato. It's kind of long and banana-shaped with a real thin skin, heavy, thick flesh wall, and not many seeds. It's the perfect canning tomato. So come mid-August, when the season's perfect, that's when they slow down the production, slow down the farming, and can the Cento San Marzano tomatoes. It's harvested with complete sustainability, and it's the best tomatoes, everybody agrees, for tomato sauce. All of Cento's San Marzano tomatoes, from the seeds to the fields to the farms to the production facility, are certified by an independent agency which guarantees the traceability. It's what I use when I want to make great tomato sauce at home. Cento San Marzano tomatoes.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Again, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or just on our website, HeritageRadioNetwork.org. My guest is Michael Ruhlman, who has been one of my favorite food writers. I'm pretty picky about books I read. I'm a chef, so a lot of the books I get, let's just say 95%, I look at the recipes and say, this won't work. This is nonsense. Who is this idiot? And they end up going to the Strand. Well, they'll sell them to somebody. I just give them the books. Michael's books have always been the exception, so congratulations on that. You went to cooking school. You're a CIA grad.
Honorary grad. I didn't. I went there as a journalist.
Okay.
I didn't intend to become a cook, but then I quickly learned when my chef called me a wimp in much more fierce terms, that in order to write about what it meant to be a cook, you had to become one because the changes are internal. Yeah. You have to change how you think. And so I did become a cook there. I went through all the kitchens, and by the end of it, I was working the hotline at the best restaurant at the CIA, went home and wrote a book about it. So that's how I got my training.
And good enough that Thomas Kelly trusted you to write the French Laundry cookbook
that
with
was
him.
A gift.
So
that was a gift from him.
That's a gold standard. All right, your latest offerings, The Book of Schmaltz, which I love, my very, very first job at the age of 13, and I don't know what the year was, a long time ago. I don't even know who was President Johnson, maybe. Jaime's Deli, Murray and PA. Big shout out to all you Philadelphia fans down there. Jaime's is still in business. Great deli. So when I saw the Book of Schmaltz, I'm like, you're kidding. But no, you're not. And I like it because you're making me stoked to go home and make some schmaltz and play around. Let's talk about some of the recipes now. Chopped liver is sort of this iconic deli standard. And for the most part, 95% of the chopped liver I have, I just can't stand. It's kind of gross. It's gross. It's too dry. The textures are wrong. I'm wondering the source of the livers to begin with. But the ones that are great are absolutely transformative. You can take this little meat that most people find in the cavity of the chicken and put in their trash can with the next move. You can turn it into something sublime. Talk about your recipe for chopped liver, where you got it.
It's very simple. It comes directly from Lois with one change that she thinks I'm absolutely insane and out of my mind, and I'll talk about that. But it was this recipe. This was the first recipe I did. I'd never made chopped liver. It's the first time I put schmaltz to use, and it was an absolute revelation. She encouraged me to get good livers. This is critical. Go to your farmer's market.
Yep.
That's, you know, the deli cup in the meat section of your grocery store, bad liver. It's not going to give you the good chopped liver. So get a good source of liver. There's plenty now. Ask a farmer's market to save it for you. There's tons. They've got more than they can handle. So get good liver, make your schmaltz, then you simply saute some onion in that schmaltz. You cook your livers fairly hard. I cook them pretty like medium well.
Yeah.
And then you simply chop. Lois grinds it. You can chop it with a mezzaluna in a round chopping,
right,
which is how Grandma probably did it, with some egg. But
pre-cooked eggs, a hard-boiled egg.
Hard-boiled egg.
To the side.
Yeah. Again, this is a cuisine. Jewish cuisine, Ashkenazi Jewish cuisine, was born of poverty. So they use simple ingredients. They use the fat from the chicken. They use the liver. They used egg to give it more nourishment, and it gives a great flavor. I think it is best ground through put through a grinder. That's how I've done it every way. Food processor works fine. I like the texture passed through the coarse meal of a grinder. Then you season it. Lois calls it moistening it with some more schmaltz. That gives it that really rich schmaltzy flavor. And then season with salt and pepper to taste, always to taste. And I add a few drops, and you will understand this as a chef, but Lois thinks I'm crazy. I add a few drops of red wine vinegar because it's such a rich dish. It needs that counterpoint, that balance that some acidity gives to it. But that's all there is to it, and it's a revelation. It's fabulous.
Yeah, it's red. I think you're right, especially with dishes with a high fat content. Any dishes. Chefs love lemon juice in the kitchen. They love vinegars in the kitchen. It's like a polishing ingredient. And you also mentioned salted a little more aggressively than you normally would season hot food, because for the most part, you're eating chopped liver out of the refrigerator or in that 40-degree range when you need a little pop, a little extra salt.
Thank you for mentioning that. It's a great point for all cold food. Yeah. That's a great lesson to learn, that you need to season a little higher food that's going to be eaten cold. So if you're cooking something that's hot, but it's going to be served cold, you want it to be just a little too salty so that it will be perfectly seasoned when you eat it cold, when it's you don't have those aromas and flavors that you get from hot food.
Yeah, we all learned this making pâtés and terrines and all that stuff that was served cold, that you basically over-season them because that's what make the flavor pop. And salt, we'll talk about that too. You know, people talk about salt being so bad for you, and I don't eat any processed foods to speak of. Like you, I'm sure I cook for myself all the time. So the salt that I take, I can measure between my index finger and my thumb, and I'm sure it's a fraction of a teaspoon a day. But it's so important for these recipes. I mean, we talk about salt in baking. Anybody at home that's listening that has any baking recipe you have, whether it's pound cake, genoise, chocolate chip cookies, brownies, there's a quarter teaspoon of salt in there somewhere. Leave that salt out as an experiment next time and taste what you've made. It tastes like nothing.
Well,
zero.
You say there's something missing.
Right.
Here.
It's this flavor amplifier that the tiniest little amount just brings the flavor out. So don't be afraid of salt. I'm going to ask you two more recipes. We're going to get to Cholent because I have the greatest memories of eating it at the old Second Avenue Deli when Abe was still alive here in New York City. Matzo balls. I've never made them at home. I've had great ones. I've had a heck of bad ones. Talk about matzo balls, because these are, I mean, they can be little cannonballs that kill you, or they can be ethereally wonderful and light and perfect. Talk about them.
Well, there are indeed two camps, and Lois and I discussed this at length. There are the people who want the sinkers, the really dense, heavy matzo ball. And there are people who like the floaters, the lighter version. I like the lighter version. Yeah. And it's really a matter of how much liquid you add to the matzo meal. That will depend on how much, you know, how dense your matzo ball is. It's just, you know, like it's basically a cup of matzo meal with four eggs, some, I like to put some sauteed onion, but it's not necessary. And then you add some stock or water, and you add some schmaltz and mix it together and roll it into balls and cook them for 20 to 30 minutes, and you have absolutely wonderful soup. But the key to matzo ball soup, the key to great matzo ball soup is not the matzo ball, it's the stock, it's the chicken broth. If you're buying Swanson's canned
forget about it.
Don't even bother.
Yeah.
So
comment about chicken fat and keeping the chicken livers. I mean, I teach some cooking classes in New York at the 92nd Street Y during the year once a month, and I do a class on chicken, and I tell people, buy whole chickens. They're fresher, they're better, they're cheaper. They may as well come with zippers. They're so easy to butcher. The thigh comes off with one pop. You can separate them. The breast comes. There's a bone to follow. And then when you have these carcasses, save them, put them in the freezer in a bag. When you have two or three, and it's a autumn or winter day, put them in a pot with a little water and some vegetables, bring it to a simmer. An hour and a half later, you've got chicken stock.
I do it with just the carcass of a roasted chicken that we have on Monday night. I just put it in a pot of water, and the next day I have a liter of delicious chicken stock.
Yeah, you can't.
So one carcass will give you a liter of stock.
Super simple to make, super great. And I remember, again, Second Avenue Deli back in the day when Abe ran it before his tragic early passing. They had a great chef in the kitchen, African-American guy, black guy from down south, and I guess he probably learned cooking like a lot of the guys I came up with in Philadelphia in the service, and he made their chicken stock had beef shanks in it.
Oh, really?
To fortify it, because it was this really gelatinous, intense stock, and I remember thinking being in the kitchen with him, and he said, yeah, man, I put beef shanks in that too, just to you know, kosher, it was everything was kosher, so kosher beef shanks as well, but really fortified
it. Give you body,
Knishes, because your first here, you have a great story about sort of your very first job making God knows what, you know, $4 an hour as a copy boy for the Times, walking across town needing knishes. Talk about this dish.
Well, knishes, that's why they're close to my heart, because I love the knishes of New York City, which are no longer allowed to be sold because of Giuliani, I believe.
Bloomberg. They just keep cutting back everything. Yeah. Who knows?
And so I had a fondness in my heart for these, and I said, Lois, do you have a knish recipe? Of course she had a knish recipe, and she taught me how to make the dough and how thin you had to roll the dough. It's a very thin dough. And again, it's basically a potato dumpling. That you can fry or bake, and you make a nice pastry, and you roll it out. You make what is basically mashed potato, delicious mashed potatoes, flavored with schmaltz and onion and gribbenas, and you basically roll it up like like ravioli in the rectangles. You make a roll, a sheet of pasta, a roll of the potato filling, and you roll it up, and you pinch it off, and you bake it or fry it. And with a little mustard, there's nothing better than a great knish.
And now we should announce that Michael's a newly minted resident of the West Village of Manhattan. My old neighborhood, I'm jealous. I had to move to Lower East Side because I just got priced out of my old hood. But down on Lower East Side, Yonah Schimmel still makes great knishes right on Houston Street on the same block as Russ and Daughter. So, yes, hop on your bike, make a long walk. It's worth the pilgrimage. All right, let's get to Choland, because here's a dish that I've heard pronounced a million ways. It's if you don't know what Choland is, folks, if you're listening, I should re-identify it. My guest is Michael Ruhlman. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Mike Colomeco. The show is Food Talk, and we're talking about the Book of Schmaltz, which is really this sort of cuisine of Middle Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe, the Ashkenazi tribe. I just got back from Poland, where I was immersed in it for 10 or 12 days, eating nothing but their version of this kind of food. And I remember Choland from Second Avenue Deli, because it was probably the last great New York deli that had a full deli menu. Carnegie Now is kind of glorified. Katz's is really a great sandwich shop, but deli food in New York is almost extinct. But the Choland there was unbelievable.
Why? Describe it. I want to hear how this
was. I think it was just so satisfying on so many levels. It was one of those dishes you'd come in on a winter day, and chefs love braised dishes, because you're just coaxing all that flavor out of a cut of meat that's turning collagen to gelatin over time with moisture. So you had that beautiful, meaty quality to it. The broth was super rich. If I'm not mistaken, he had barley and grains and root vegetables. And it was just this plate of food that when you left, you knew you'd eaten something that was great for you. Talk about your discovery of it and how you make it, because there's a million variations.
Well, I really want to make this dish because, as you said, it's a great braised dish. It's a rich, satisfying, soul-satisifying dish. And yet, anytime I brought it up with Lois, she'd go, "Oh, Choland!" Horrible memories of Choland because it was cooked badly. The reason for Choland was it was for the Sabbath lunch. You didn't work on Saturday, so you'd make it
the night before
sundown. And traditionally, in the villages, in the poor villages, they'd all take their pots to the baker who had finished baking the bread and had banked the fire, and they'd all cook it overnight. And that would be their meal the next day. And so that's how the dish originated. And it's just a big stew of all the stuff that potatoes and beans and kishki and cheap beef shank or short ribs or cheap cuts of tough beef. So because Lois hated so much, it was sort of a personal challenge to make a great Choland. I started thinking about it, and it's not that much different from a traditional French cassoulet, which is an awesome dish. So why couldn't Choland be an awesome dish? So I created a way of making it like a cassoulet, but making it kosher, just by using veal and beef bones, veal for the body and the richness that you wouldn't eat.
But you use a veal breast, right?
I use a veal breast because that has a good ratio of meat. And bone and fat and cartilage.
Yeah.
Which is so it gives you a lot of body. And then you've got beef short ribs in there, which cook low and slow and flavor the broth as well. And then kishki, which is, again, a very simple but traditional dish. Kishki meant intestine, but it was the matzah meal and cooked vegetables that went into the intestine that was then cooked. So that would traditionally be part of a choland. Potatoes and vegetables, whatever you had, and beans. And so I just tried to make it a little more elegant by taking my training as a cook And making an elegant, beautiful cassoulet-like preparation of this traditional Jewish dish.
Which, sadly, I don't know if there's a menu in New York that has it, which is kind of tragic, but that's what's happening.
They will soon.
Why? My guest has been Michael Ruhlman. The name of his book is The Book of Schmaltz. You're listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find us at that website, download it and listen to it anytime. We're at iTunes, we're at Stitcher. We'll have more of this coming up. Stay tuned. I'll be back. Hey, I am back. You're listening again to Heritage Radio Network. The show is Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. We're going to close it out today. We've got a couple more minutes to talk about stuff. And all right, I won't talk about fat or salt anymore. I did a little open where I went on, and then I listened to the interview, and I'm like, okay, all right, enough. Everybody gets the idea. But let's talk about something else. We've got about 5-10 minutes left to go before we shut the show down today. If you're living in and around the Northeast right now and you're listening to this live, it's October, it's winding down, we're in the middle of fall harvest, and the apple crop of 2013 is like the biggest bumper crop that most people can remember. We're coming off of a couple of years when they've had disastrous crops, both of them courtesy of hurricanes. Irene, which came over Labor Day weekend 2 years ago, and Sandy, which, as we all remember in the New York area, came just prior to Halloween last year, really taking the apple crop off the market for the most part, lots and lots of damage. But this year, it's back, and it's back in a big way. The yields are great. The quality of the apples are great. Apples are funny trees. As we you know, this is called Heritage Radio Network, as we're getting into heritage breeds of things. When you go to like Union Square Market, and I was there yesterday, I like to go on Wednesdays. That's the day when the food scene there is pretty much full on. There's a great fishmonger there from the North Fork of Long Island that's got really, really, really good seafood. And you're also supporting a local fisher family and the fisheries. And of course, apples are like everywhere. And I love to pick up like not the regular varieties, but sort of the funny ones. I bought a bunch of macoons yesterday and some local galas. But we're seeing in the apple world, the apple orchards now look a lot different than they did. They're making trees now that are not nearly as tall, so they're easier to harvest. So they're kind of smaller trees that you can plant with much more density. But there's still great apple farmers out there that are kind of using old heritage breeds from bigger, older trees that just really suck up that terroir. There's just something about what magical that happens when a tree can establish its roots deep down and give you this fruit once a year. And a lot of the older breeds, one of the reasons people got away with them is apples are funny. Often, characteristically, they give you a great yield year followed by a not-so-great year, followed by a great year and then not-so-great. That's just the nature of the fruit on the tree and the nature of the tree. Well, this year it's amazing. So we've got this wonderful apple crop. So get yourselves to any of the great green markets that New York has all over the place these days and celebrate. And I'll give a couple of recipes out, which I'll do from time to time on this show. One of the things I love to do with fresh apples, and it's so easy to make at home, is just great fresh apple sauce. It's great the day you make it. It's great for, 5 days a week in the refrigerator. And it's about the easiest thing in the world to make, okay? The only thing you're going to need is a pot with a lid, a little bit of salt, maybe a touch of honey or sugar if you want. I don't use cinnamon in mine. You can if you want. A bunch of apples, drop or two of lemon juice, and a food mill. And a food mill, if you don't have one, go get one, because there's a lot of recipes that I give out that require a food mill. They're really inexpensive. And a food mill, if you don't know, is that thing that it's round and has a handle on top and usually has a couple of different grates that you can insert in it with holes in them of varying sizes. And it's meant to sit on top of something, and you simply pour something into the top of it, you spin that little spinning thing around, and it forces whatever's on the top through the holes to the bottom and catches what you don't want in it. It's how I make my passata tomato sauce every fall, and I use it for applesauce as well. So to make applesauce at home, it's real simple. Get the kind of apples that you like to eat. You can mix them up, whatever you want. Wash them, and then you do nothing else. Wash them, and then chop them into big pieces, the whole apple, the stem, the seeds, everything, the skin, the whole apple. Chop them up, get a pan that has a lid. A heavy-duty pan would be better, but if you don't have one of those, any kind of a pan that has a lid that fits will work. Get those chopped apples, just a little bit of water, maybe 2 or 3 tablespoons of water, a couple drops of lemon juice, pinch of salt, bring it up to a simmer on the stove, put a lid on, turn it down to the lowest flame setting that you have. and just let it cook. You'll see steam coming out of the top. The apples will begin to break down. Maybe in the first 10 minutes, open that lid once in a while just to give it a turn, and you'll see what's going on. You'll see what's going on in the pan. Just turn them with a wooden spoon, put the lid back on, wait. In about a half an hour's time, lift the lid up, get a paring knife, pass them through the apples. If they're completely tender, they're done, put that lid back and let it sit. And in about 45 minutes to an hour, take that lid off. While it's still warm, pass it through a food mill. The food mill will catch all the seeds. It'll catch the stem. It'll grind everything else up. And what comes out the bottom is this beautiful homemade applesauce. Taste it at that point. If you think it needs to be adjusted, that's the time to add a pinch of salt. That's the time maybe to sweeten it with a little bit of honey or agave or sugar or the sweetener of your choice. And you've got applesauce at home to make. That it's that simple. 45 minutes, one, two, three. Another quick apple dish that I make that's great if you're I'm not a great baker. The whole pastry baking half of the brain is that sort of analytical mathematical stuff. It's sort of like if you think of cooking as like jazz or rock and roll or the blues, where you sort of have it, okay, it's in B flat and it's in 4/4 and we're going to do it a little differently every time. That's kind of how cooks cook, whereas baking is very much like classical music. You know, if Bach wrote the notes on the page, those are the notes that you play, and that's how you get it done. Baking is the same way. Baking, you really have to follow recipes. You really have to be cognizant of timing, of technique, of temperatures, going into the recipe, all sorts of stuff. Baking science, pure and simple, which is a subject I was never great at, and hence I'm not much of a baker. But I came up with this probably, I don't really remember, but it was probably out of necessity. I was probably entertaining friends, and I had to come up with some quick dessert. So this is a real simple apple dessert that I love. That's so simple, you'll love it too. So get the apple that you like. I kind of like to use the more sour apples for this recipe. Granny Smith's work beautifully. Those green apples, you can peel them or not. If you want to go super fancy, peel them. If not, don't worry about it. But wash them, dry them, chop them up into nice small dice, and hold them off to the side. You're going to need some 10X sugar and a pinch of salt. A little bit of vanilla would be great if you have vanilla bean or vanilla flavoring. That'd be wonderful. And that's it. Once those apples are diced, get a nice wide saute pan on the stove. Put 10X sugar into that pan. Turn the flame up high. You have to stay with this recipe. You cannot walk away. Anytime you're cooking sugar, you have to be right there with the pan. So you've got a hot pan. You've got 10X sugar covering the bottom of that pan. That 10X sugar will slowly start to caramelize. Once it begins to caramelize, move it around with a wooden spoon so that it's you're mixing the 10X that isn't caramelized with the stuff that is. Once you've got that 10X in a liquid form, put all the apples right in that same pan. The sugar will seize up, because that's what always happens when the temperature changes. Don't worry about it. Sugar will seize up. The apples will begin to wick out some apple juice, because suddenly they're in a hot pan. The caramel that you made with the 10X sugar will pick up that apple juice. Just toss them around in the pan. It takes about 4 to 5 minutes. Move them around. Keep that flame good and high. And what you'll see is you're caramelizing the apples with the caramel that was in the pan, as well as cooking them. After about 4 or 5 minutes, you're going to have this beautiful stuff in the pan that basically looks like apple pie filling, which is, for all intents and purposes, exactly what it is. Pinch of salt. If you want to squeeze a little vanilla bean in, that would be the time, or a pinch of vanilla extract. And it's just this wonderful, literally it tastes like the inside of an apple pie, but with fine dice. It's the exact same thing, and it takes 5 minutes from start to finish. Serve it with a little crispy cookie, maybe a little bit of vanilla ice cream, or an ice cream would be great. Serve it warm, because again, it only takes 5 minutes to make. So warm with ice cream or whipped cream or a little cookie. Your friends will be impressed. Hey, there you go. Two recipes, interview with Michael Ruhlman on the Book of Schmaltz, and that's going to wrap up today's show. You have been listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back next week, where I think we're going to be talking about wine, because it has been the crush everywhere around the world, and I talk about wine all the time. It's what I drink for dinner every night. Anyway, again, thanks for listening. The show's been Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Log on, donate, stay tuned for more. They've got great programming, top to bottom, 7 days a week. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.